Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear for argument from petitioner in Feldman versus Marks. Justice Baker is recused from the deliberation or decision of this case.
May I please report Mr. Kenneth W. Starr will present argument from the petitioner. Petitioner, please, there
are 5 minutes. May I please report? This case brings before the court an important question under Rule 76A of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, as well as an issue concerning the lawfulness and the imposition of costs against the United States. The Rule 76A question...
Mr. Starr, there's nothing in the opinion that addresses costs. Where did the costs come from?
It is set forth in the court's judgment. There is no opinion supporting the judgment.
Court costs or expenses?
Costs. Court costs, not attorney's fees. It was not fee shifting, but it was an imposition of costs.
On that cost issue, isn't it true that under the statute that I think you were arguing to support your position, that costs can be recovered by someone against whom an indictment was brought, but the indictment was dismissed?
Yes, there is that provision, which indicates precisely our point in that respect, an express waiver of sovereign immunity, which is a matter entrusted to the Congress of the United States.
And in this situation, we have an indictment that was brought against Mr. Mark, and the indictment was later dismissed.
At the same time, that judgment has been reversed by the United States Court of Appeals by the Eighth Circuit.
The judgment dismissing the indictment has been reversed?
Yes.
Okay, so is the indictment back in place now?
Well, it is in the sense that the specific status is Mr. Marks' petition for Supreme Court review, and that petition is presently pending, and we believe it's going to be on the first list of the Supreme Court's upcoming term. But no, that judgment was in fact reversed, and that was not the basis of the action of the Court of Appeals. I should note that just in terms of the timing, this judgment was entered prior to Judge Woods's, we believe, with all respect to Judge Woods, ill-conceived dismissal of the indictment, and indeed, as I say, that indictment was restored by a unanimous Court of Appeals panel of the Eighth Circuit. So that will not do in terms of the waiver of sovereign immunity, and we think that that issue is quite straightforward and clear in light of the clear case law which we have submitted to the Court of Appeals.
If the United States Supreme Court were to reverse the circuit, would that have an impact on the imposition of costs last year by our Court of Appeals?
I don't think so because of the timing again. It was not, Your Honor, awarded. Costs were not awarded by virtue of, gee, the indictment has now been dismissed. It simply was not the basis of it. The costs were, in fact, imposed by virtue of what? The Court of Appeals did not say, but simply by virtue of its entering judgment that the proceeding before the district court, which is really what brings us here today, was, in fact, inappropriate. And I think it stands alone, not on the basis of what may happen or may not happen in the United States District Court, the Court of Appeals, or the United States Supreme Court. And it is to the principal issue, unless there are further questions with respect to the cost issue, which I would obviously be happy to address, that I do want to turn to in my argument. We believe that what is presently before the court is the issue of whether the transcript of the proceeding before the district court was properly sealed, and whether that should now remain sealed. And we believe it's quite important to get at the focus of what is at issue, which is the meaning of Rule 76A. We believe that is what this case is about.
I'm unclear just about the record briefly. Was the sealed transcript taken to the Court of Appeals? Did the Court of Appeals examine that in the course of issuing its opinion in this case?
No.
Where is the record? Where is that part of the record currently?
To the best of our knowledge, the sealed transcript is presently in the records of the district court in Dallas. The sealed transcript was a part of the record as this case proceeded on mandamus to the Court of Appeals and then to this court. Mandamus by Mr. Marks was denied, and then the sealed transcript was returned to the district court, and that is where it is. There is no indication whatsoever in the Court of Appeals opinion that there is an examination of the sealed transcript. And thus this case comes before this court with the heavy presumption that what the United States was doing in that proceeding was to inform the district judge of the pendency and the scope and the nature of the ongoing Whitewater investigation in Little Rock, and how that investigation, one aspect of the investigation, centered upon the business activities of then-Governor Jim Guy Tucker and his business partner, William Marks Sr., which included a fraudulent bankruptcy, as alleged by the grand jury, in the Northern District of Texas. We were informed of the Rule 187 proceeding, the effort by Mr. Marks to take the deposition of his former accountant, Mr. Feldman, literally days before the deposition was to be taken. We immediately sought to intervene in this very fast-moving proceeding. The chronology of these events reflects a very quick movement of activity in the month of October 1994, following in the wake of Mr. Marks having been informed that he was one, target of the grand jury's investigation. We were unaware of this effort by Mr. Marks to take the deposition. What was our position?
Well, before you move on, how is that in any way, shape, or form disclosure, an improper disclosure of some federal grand jury proceedings in Little Rock? To ask your accountant, your previous accountant, questions about records and transactions that were conducted by the accountant?
Your Honor, it is not a violation of grand jury secrecy for an accountant willingly to give the information to his former client. But the accountant was not willing to do that, and as a result, Mr. Marks invoked the civil process of this state. By virtue of the invocation of civil process of this state, we had, in effect, parallel proceedings. We had an ongoing criminal investigation in Little Rock, which was extremely sensitive at the time, and which we said, Judge, we simply want to make you aware of the investigation, and we want to have a postponement of the deposition to balance, which is traditional in the law, to balance the competing interests of the criminal justice system and the civil justice system.
But that was prior to an indictment.
That was prior, exactly. That was prior to the indictment, indeed.
But now the indictment's come and gone, or at least it's in some processes, but
yes.
The timeliness is no longer crucial.
That's exactly right. Indeed, he has taken the deposition. That is why what remains in this court is a very important principle under 76A. The practical impact on Mr. Marks is, as far as I can discern as an officer of the court, zero, because he has since taken the Feldman deposition.
So is
that
moved
forward? We indicated once the indictment had come down, the grand jury's work is over. We have no objection to the deposition proceeding, and it in fact did.
Do you object to unsealing?
Yes, we do,
that's
Your Honor, because that information which we provided to the district court without the presence of the lawyers, able lawyers, for the target of the grand jury was and continues to be grand jury information.
Forever?
How do we know that? Without having the transcript, how in the world do we know that? There could be some information, perhaps a lot of information, in that sealed transcript that would not be grand jury information, which could in fact be your own investigation. But without the transcript here, how in the world are we just supposed to take your word for it?
Your Honor, I think it was incumbent on my learned colleagues on the other side to see to it that that sealed transcript was in the record of the Court of Appeals. It wasn't. That's my understanding of Rule 50D and case law under 50D. It was not a part of the record. Therefore, I benefit from the presumption, which to me, Your Honor, is a common sense and natural presumption, that the reason that an officer of the United States goes into the district judge to say, I'm a federal prosecutor, I'm working with a federal grand jury in Little Rock, here's what that grand jury is investigating. It's a natural common sense inference to be drawn, but more than that, we have a presumption from 50D. It may very well be, let me take that the burden of your question, it may very well be that there are certain parts of the sealed transcript that do not contain grand jury information. It may very well be, and we obviously have no objection to the release of such information. The problem is that sealed transcript was not made a part of the Court of Appeals record, and it was because we were not the appellants in that proceeding. It was the duty and burden of the other side to make sure that that was in the record. But we have no objection whatsoever, as a matter of principle, to the release of information that's not grand jury information. I think Justice Spector's concern is, does it remain grand jury information indefinitely? And it does, Your Honor. The proceedings before a grand jury remain confidential under the common law of this state. This is not simply federal law, but the traditions of this state, as illustrated by the Court of Appeals opinion for San Antonio and the Stern case, in Stern versus the state of Texas, chronicling in a very learned way the history and traditions of grand jury secrecy in this state.
If counsel had disclosed same information to just a friend on the street, then the cat would be out of the bag, I suppose. The friend could then use it however they want to.
The friend would be under no obligation. You're right, Justice Hack.
Why isn't then the disclosure to a trial judge, if it was improper, why doesn't that have the same effect?
Oh, I don't think that that was an improper disclosure. I think that we were entitled to make the judge aware, either through affidavits or through representations of counsel. And because of the press of events, we made representations. We had no time.
But if it were improper, would it be like disclosure to a friend on the street?
No, Your Honor, because it seems to me that at that point, you still look to what is the duty in terms of the integrity of the administration of justice. A court is not the friend on the street. A court is still a court governed by principles of law. And under the traditions of this state, although the friend may not be obligated to protect grand jury secrecy, the friend would not. It's a free society. He could speak at will. The court is, because the courts of Texas, like the courts of its sister states, abide by principles of grand jury secrecy and protect them. They protect it for the benefit and welfare of individuals and individual liberty.
Mr. Starr, in Texas, it's not uncommon for parties or lawyers to submit something to a judge in camera for the judge to look at and decide whether or not the judge is going to seal it, return it to the party submitting it, or reveal it to everyone else. What is uncommon, in fact, perhaps unprecedented in Texas, is that in the process of that sealing, one of the lawyers for one of the sides gets to go back into the chambers and have an ex parte contact with the judge. Tell me why it would not have been the proper procedure for you all to just go ahead and submit whatever it was you wanted submitted in camera, even if you needed to provide a statement to the judge, it could be done by affidavit. And tell me why this court should allow and permit these types of ex parte contacts.
Because of the strictures under which this particular officer of the United States was operating. And I ask you, before you come to judgment, to bear in mind what the officer of the United States is obligated to do. Unlike Mr. Davis, who can stand here and tell you anything that he knows about the grand jury, I cannot. And neither could that lawyer who was dispatched on a Southwest Airlines airplane from Little Rock to Dallas, could not reveal to the target of the grand jury information. Why? To get some advantage over the individual? No, because that officer would run the danger of being in contempt of court. That officer of the court, a servant of the grand jury, cannot reveal that information to the world at large. But it is, in fact, clear under precedent, and I refer in particular this court to the Fifth Circuit's decision, which is discussed in the briefs, but I think it merits the court's careful discussion and study, In re Eisenberg, where the Court of Appeals unanimously upheld the very procedure that we're talking about, Justice Abbott. Why? Because in distinction to the usual case, if I may complete my answer, in distinction to the usual case where it is parties in civil litigation, here we have the ancient traditions of grand jury secrecy. That's what makes this case unique.
In Eisenberg, was there any ex parte testimony?
It was in the form of affidavits.
Were those affidavits shown to anyone on the opposing side?
No.
Of the United States government?
They were not, because they contained grand jury information, and that was the point.
How lengthy were those affidavits? Is that clear in the record?
It's not entirely clear in the record here, but let me say...
There can be an affidavit that says enclosure 48 documents, all of them have been submitted to the grand jury, and that's one thing.
Yeah.
An affidavit that goes on for pages and pages explaining what's in them, it may be quite something else.
It could be, Your Honor, but again, what was the purpose? And I think, again, I would invoke context and the exigencies under which we found ourselves. This proceeding got underway, if I may answer, this proceeding got underway by virtue of the invocation of Rule 187, this pre-litigation procedure, to take the deposition. Nowhere in that verified petition did Mr. Marks inform the district court judges that there was a grand jury investigation underway. This began, and the deposition was ordered on a hurry-up basis, without the judges having been informed that there was a grand jury investigation. We then find out very shortly before the deposition is scheduled, and as a result, we hasten. We could have filed an affidavit had time permitted, but the deposition was literally scheduled for the next day after this hearing that we summoned ourselves to. That is the reason that we proceeded in the way we did. It was not anything beyond, Your Honor, representations by a officer of the United States as to what was happening before the grand jury.
Are you asking that this decision that you seek be premised on the supremacy clause, or would our decision be equally applicable to a state grand jury proceeding?
Your Honor, I am asking, if I may, in very briefly, asking you to decide this under Rule 76A, not supremacy clause. 76A, what this issue now is about, there have been lots of issues along the way, but is do you now unseal that transcript? And, Your Honor, we invoke Rule 76A.
Was 76A ever written with a view in mind for parties using it, or was it, doesn't it speak
yes,
solely
indeed.
To the world at large?
Well, I think it is clear that a party, whatever our status might eventually be, we clearly were concerned with what? And I refer the court specifically to Part 2 in 76A and the definition of court records. And that exception includes, the exceptions to court records includes documents in court files to which access is otherwise restricted by law. And in response to your question, Chief Justice Phillips, we're not invoking the supremacy clause, we're invoking 76A. It was
it seems to me, assumes that the parties know what's in these records, and the question is, can someone who's not a party to the lawsuit have access to it? That's the premise behind the whole thing. It's not that one party might use some words in 76A to keep the other party.
I think in the ordinary operation, forgive me for interrupting, I think in the ordinary operation rule you're exactly right. But I think that the issue that now comes before the court is an interpretation question. And can we prevail upon this court to interpret 76A? The only authority that is being cited for unsealing what is now a sealed transcript is 76A. And we think 76A is manifestly inapplicable because of the exceptions set forth in Section 2, defining court records. And that narrowly is what this case, given its present posture, is about. Do you now order unsealed information that should naturally be assumed in addition to the presumption contains grand jury information? It's a serious step. It is a step that clearly the crafters of 76A did not, in fact, envision. Even its most fervent proponents, such as Justice Doggett, in his law review article, says 76A is not designed to interfere with the law enforcement records function.
Any other questions?
Does the grand jury proceedings at some point become available to Mr. Marks?
It might, under provisions of federal law such as Jinx Act material and Brady material and the like. But no, not...
And is it important to the outcome of this case whether what was revealed by the prosecutor to the trial judge in this case in the ex parte hearing was confined solely to matters affecting Mr. Marks or whether it may have affected other ongoing investigations?
No.
Is that important?
I don't think it's important. I think it is a prudential factor that the court should bear in mind that it does not know, by the design of our grand jury system, what is going on before the grand jury, and that revelations with respect to what occurred before the grand jury are so fraught with potential mischief and danger that it is much better to err on the side of caution, and I think that's what the crafters of 76A had in mind. Do not, in fact, use 76A as a bludgeon to open up records that are otherwise closed, access to which is denied.
Any other questions?
I thank,
thank
the
you,
court.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Yes, Could
you distinguish the Eisenberg case?
Yes, Your Honor, I would be happy to. The Eisenberg case dealt with an attempt to take a deposition of a government officer, a deposition whose purpose was to achieve, according to the opinion of the court, discovery in a civil case which had no legitimate purpose. The distinction, in our view, is our client was trying to find out about his own income tax returns, and the facts may help us here if I can briefly relate to them. That is, Mr. Marks had for 9 years used an accountant named Mr. Feldman. He had presumably discharged his duty and filed the tax returns, which he had prepared and which had been signed by the taxpayer. He presumably had sent the tax payment in to the Internal Revenue Service. He presumably had kept the records for those 9 years. When for the first time Mr. Marks heard from the government that those returns might not have been filed or the money might not have been received, he attempted to contact the fiduciary, Mr. Feldman, to ask him, what about this? Mr. Feldman declined to talk. And the only way which was available to Mr. Marks to discharge his obligation to the United States to see if the returns were filed and if not to do so, to see if the tax was paid and if not to do so, to secure the records necessary for this function, the only doorway open to Mr. Marks was to take a deposition, not directed at discovering grand jury information, but finding out what his accountant had done with his own records.
Is there any limitation on the discovery that a target of a grand jury investigation may undertake from witnesses who have appeared before the grand jury or supplied information to the grand jury?
Absolutely none. And that is the most shocking part of sitting here.
No limitation?
None whatsoever. Let me make the point, if I may. As I sit here as a criminal defense lawyer, and that's what I've done for 36 years, hearing this posturing about grand jury secrecy and confidences, I am shocked. There is no restraint whatsoever in the federal rules of civil procedure or otherwise placed upon someone who wishes to talk to a witness, and no restraint placed on a witness who wishes to talk to someone. In fact, it is the routine practice throughout the United States every day where grand juries sit, for defense lawyers to sit outside the grand jury room and accost the people who leave the grand jury room and say, would you please talk?
But Mr. Feldman didn't want to talk to us.
That's correct, Your Honor. He didn't want to talk to us. But there's nothing whatsoever wrong with beginning a good faith, legitimate lost it, to determine what the truth is for Mr. Marks. His interest is accumulating if he owes a tax. His penalties are accumulating if he owes a tax.
Why shouldn't a target of a grand jury proceeding file a peremptory lawsuit against witnesses who they anticipate will give grand jury information and undertake a course of discovery to determine what it is they're going to say? Doesn't that undermine the secrecy of the grand jury operation?
Frankly, not at all. And that's because Rule 6E2 makes it clear there is no restraint on a witness, on a defense lawyer, on a putative defendant whatsoever in connection with these kinds of proceedings. It's very interesting to note that counsel for the United States, independent counsel, never once recited in their briefs at any level what 6E says. It is wonderfully instructive to look at what 6E2 has to say. And I will only refer the court to two sentences because they're so powerful in their command. The rule is captioned General Rule of Secrecy. And it first, in the first sentence, says that grand jurors, attorneys for the government, those who transcribe records, typists, and so forth, may not divulge matters occurring before the grand jury. That is the rule of secrecy. The next sentence says, no obligation of secrecy may be imposed on any person except in accordance with this rule. No obligation of secrecy. It is only the functionaries associated with the grand jury who have any limitation placed on them whatsoever. It is not witnesses. It is not putative defendants. It is not lawyers.
Well, was Mr. Feldman ever a witness? I understand he did not testify.
No, that's the second shocking thing about this whole process. We keep hearing argument about Mr. Feldman and the confidences that he divulged. The truth is, Mr. Feldman never testified to the grand jury to this day. Mr. Feldman was never called there. So to talk about this as matters occurring before the grand jury, in our view, is totally unfounded. But even if he had been called there, as I am attempting to explain, Rule 6E2 makes it clear his lips still are not sealed. There is no obligation of secrecy for him.
Mr. Davis, isn't it true that here today, though, that you have received everything that you desired to receive to begin with? You've been able to depose Mr. Feldman. You've been able to discover any and all documents that he has. As it stands, you haven't been deprived of any information other than what may have been communicated in camera to the judge.
It is possible to infer that, but that is not true. What has happened is, yes, a deposition was taken, but Mr. Feldman, either because he had legitimate fears from the government or did not, asserted the Fifth Amendment. And my client still has no information from that source, nor the potential of getting information from that source about his tax returns. The only source currently available to my client is to get into the 45 minutes worth of ex-party conversation between the attorney for the United States, or Office of Independent Counsel, and the judge.
What if no question that that lawyer had knowledge about grand jury proceedings?
There is no question that she did, but we respectfully submit she may not publish that information in this context, in balance, without the risk that it will go to the defense, as it should in this case. I would note so that everyone will understand.
What about your burden? It was your burden to bring that sealed record before the Court
of
Appeals before us, so we can make a judgment.
Your Honor, the question is a fair one. We designated that sealed material as a part of our designation in this case. There's no dispute about that. What we later found, when it did not come forward, is that the trial judge secretly had sent it to the Office of Independent Counsel. No notice was given to us that it was so dispatched. Later, we understand it might have been returned by the Office of District Counsel. But we have never seen that. We have never been given access to it. And the trial judge secretly sent it to the Office of Independent Counsel.
Before you were at the Court of Appeals, did you insist that you informed the court that there's something missing in this record?
Yes, the court certainly understood that it was missing, just as we understand it's missing. But our complaint is that the procedure that was followed was dead wrong. And that procedure
can be inferred from the statement of facts and transcript that is before this court today. One doesn't have to see what Ms. Volohogian said to the trial judge to know that the procedure that was followed is in violation not only of Rule 7-6, but fundamental principles of due process.
So are you willing to agree that the information that was disclosed to the trial judge was grand jury information?
No, Your Honor, certainly I am not. We have never been given any access to those 45 minutes of ex parte exchange. And I will make the point so that others don't misunderstand what is easily misunderstood here. There was no evidence before the trial judge in this matter at all. There was no sworn motion. There was no affidavit. There was no testimony under oath. The judge offered to place Ms. Volohogian under oath before they retired in chambers. Ms. Volohogian declined. The judge said, well, I'll hear your argument in chambers. And after they exited the chambers, the judge explained that he was making his findings based upon her argument because she was never sworn. There was never testimony. There was never evidence, which this court or any court should likely acknowledge to be right. There was no evidence that meets any of our requirements in the state of Texas before the trial judge.
Mr. Baxter, you have asserted that information was not available through the deposition and your only source of information is this hearing. The posture of the case at the time of the hearing was your request to take a deposition pre-lawsuit and the intervention of the United States Independent Counsel was to prevent the immediate deposition of Mr. Feldman. The decision of the trial judge was to prevent the immediate deposition of Mr. Feldman. Why isn't your remedy to have another, the posture, obviously you've already had your deposition. The posture of the case at the time of the hearing that you were not permitted to attend, that the court made a ruling on your request for deposition. Why isn't your remedy to have another hearing with both counsel present and the parties present on the determination of when to hold that deposition? Why isn't that your remedy?
Because Rule 76 and Rule 76A give us a right to access to everything that happened in that previous hearing. And we would respectfully suggest there are two rules here, and it is interesting that there is a studied avoidance of Rule 76 by independent counsel. And
before
there,
you get into
yes,
that,
Your Honor.
What's the difference between this and just the submission of a claimed privileged document?
That is also an excellent question. In the typical case where one asserts an attorney-client privilege or other privilege, of course, what we do and is an appropriate and approved procedure is to take the privileged material and present it to a trial judge for in-camera study. That is not what happened here. What happened here is argument in the guise of testimony was adduced. Argument was presented to a judge in chambers, which is not only wrong because it violates our disciplinary rules of professional conduct, which were affirmed by this young lawyer when she first was admitted pro hoc vici. Not only was it ethically wrong, but more, excuse me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that aside, which appears to be a serious problem, doesn't Rule 76A deal solely with court documents? I'm looking at it right now and it keeps referring to documents, which would make it seem like whatever this lawyer may have told the judge ex parte would not fall under 76A as being a court record.
Yes, there are two problems with the argument. Certainly that is one of the problems, Your Honor. 76A appears to deal with documents. But the second thing is, and not oral argument, and not testimony, if it was either of those. Instead, 76A explicitly addresses its purpose, which is open records. Court records are presumed to be open to the general public. 76A, on which counsel relies, was not intended to govern the rights of a party litigant. Instead, 76 is. And Rule 76 says, each attorney at law practicing in any court shall be allowed at all reasonable times to inspect the papers and records relating to any suit or other matter in which he may be interested. We certainly should be privileged under Rule 76 to look at the papers and our own client's cause.
Isn't that a matter that awaits a final judgment before you can complain of it?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Doesn't a Rule 76 violation, if there is one,
become reviewable only when there is some final judgment in the case?
I don't think that is there's such a limitation in Rule 76. I would not presume to instruct the court on what the law is.
Well, Rule 76A has a rather elaborate procedure for everyone in the whole state, stopping whatever else they're doing to treat of it. And Rule 76 seems to fall within the general rules, does it not, of an appeal after a judgment?
Well, I don't think Rule 76, I would respectfully suggest, is limited to post-judgment circumstances. I think there's no limitation contained within the rule and none known to me. If there is such a limitation, I'm unacquainted with it, Your Honor.
But coming back to my question.
Yes, Your Honor, if I may.
76 does not give you the right to see documents that were submitted in camera and the trial judge said were privileged.
Yes, and thank you for reminding me of your question. That's true. What happened here went beyond an in-camera submission of assertedly privileged documents. What went on was either argument treated as fact by the factual testimony by the judge or factual testimony by the judge. And we were excluded from any participation. We had no right to cross-examine, no right to advocate our view, no right to make distinctions, no right to object. And this is critical, I think. Probably 90% of what that young woman had to say, and she's a fine lawyer, by the way. This is not intended as criticism. Probably 90% of what she had to say to the court was in no sense protected. But we couldn't be there to assert that. We had no way of knowing what was happening behind that closed door for 45 minutes. And what happened when the court exited was the judge said, counsel and I have developed a plan. We'd like to offer you this plan. That's not the same as simply submitting some documents. And I make this point. The reason for an in-camera review of documents is to exclude information, to say it is privileged, the other side may not see it. The reason for this in-camera submission was to reach the merits of the motion, which we had already won. We had already gotten an order from a judge in Dallas authorizing us to take this deposition.
Who was unaware of the grand jury proceedings in Little Rock.
Well, indeed, and that is as it should be. And that is as it should be. Why should anyone publish the fact that our client is subject to grand jury review, his conduct is being evaluated?
Counsel, can you find some precedent for us in the case law anywhere across the state, federal or other states, where a person can, a target of a grand jury investigation, can institute civil deposition proceedings to find out what grand jury witnesses testified to compel those witnesses to tell the target what they said in front of the grand jury? Do you have any precedent for that?
There is no rule with that specific function. But the point we would make is Mr. Marks didn't suffer civil death just because the government decided to investigate him. He still has rights as a citizen, should have, we respectfully submit, to due process. He is entitled to pursue civil rights and remedies in good faith.
But do you have any precedent where targets of grand jury investigations have been able to compel witnesses who have testified before a grand jury to disclose what they said in front of the grand jury?
No, but I'm sure it happens all the time. There's nothing irregular about that at all. In fact, what startles me is that someone should think that Mr. Marks forfeits all of his rights as a citizen, that he can no longer expect due process from the courts.
Opposing counsel states that Mr. Feldman, as his right, refused to give this information to his client or his ex-client.
Yes.
I'm unfamiliar with that relationship. Does a client have a right to have certain papers from his account?
Yes, Your Honor. What Mr. Mark sought were two things. One was the testimony, truthful testimony of his account. The second was he sought his own records back. And neither were the records produced, nor was the testimony.
Yeah, that's my question, though. Does Mr. Feldman, under the relationship that they have a right not to give his client his own income?
Absolutely not. That rule is well settled in Texas, that a professional who comes into possession as a fiduciary of records belonging to another cannot refuse to return.
But that's secondary. You really want the testimony, and you just said so here.
Yes, we do want it. We did want the testimony additionally. We wanted both. We absolutely wanted Mr. Feldman's testimony. But Mr. Feldman doesn't have the right to refuse to testify on deposition. Mr. Feldman doesn't have the right to be in contempt of an order of a court saying appear and give truthful testimony in front of the court reporter. He has no more of that right than anyone else.
But he has a right to make the application to a district judge to stop the deposition as he did.
We think he did that. And he was heard, and he was his position was rejected. He came back a second time and then was joined by the government, who, without any notice, without any setting, filed three motions, written motions, and two oral motions. The two oral motions were a motion to seal the record that they were going to make and a request that they be heard ex parte.
Do you give any weight at all to the exigency of the context in which all this happened?
No, and the reason I don't, Your Honor, is because it is a fantasy. It is not real to say that the government has any real interest in stopping us from taking the deposition of our accountant when he has never testified to the grand jury. He is not a government witness in any sense. He happens to be our accountant, and we would respectfully urge we have rights here, too, that don't vaporize merely because they think they may want to present his testimony.
But the right you're claiming,
yes, Your Honor,
now is not to take Mr. Feldman's deposition at a particular time. That battle is passed. The right you're claiming now is to see what you claim the independent counsel waived by submitting to the district judge, voluntarily or improperly disclosed.
Yes, that is precisely what we say, and we believe that both because due process affords us the opportunity to see the evidence that is presented in the civil proceeding, as well as our interpretation of Rule 76 and 76A, entitles us to see that information.
We've said in the past that an affidavit concerning privilege submitted ex parte in camera cannot support the ruling, but those cases are not exactly apropos here because you also want to see the affidavit, the material submitted. In this case, it was testimony or statements or argument.
Yes, we feel if argument is presented against us, if testimony is presented against us to decide the merits of a matter, we should be entitled under due process principles to have access.
What's the status of your dispute with Mr. Feldman at this time?
It depends. And my client, who still does not know what happened to his records and still does not know whether the returns were filed and what happened to the checks, is awaiting some knowledge that will serve as the basis to begin a lawsuit.
There has still been no lawsuit filed. It's still just the
Well,
one
a lawsuit has been filed.
All right.
Yes.
And it pins him?
Yes, there was a lawsuit filed on the merits of our claim against Mr. Feldman.
And it pins in the district court?
Yes. There is an independent proceeding involving Mr. Feldman.
The record of the ex parte hearing that
yes.
you would like a copy of the transcript of, you contend contains evidence or merely argument of counsel?
Well,
I think I've heard you.
And yes, infer, and I'll give you the basis of the evidence, Your Honor, we infer only argument because Ms. Wolohodian refused to be sworn before she went. The judge asked her to be sworn. She said, I don't need to be sworn. She was not, and after she exited, the judge said he has heard her argument twice.
If that's true,
yes.
And there was no evidence presented
yes.
against your client, on what basis are you entitled to arguments of counsel,
Absolutely.
Other than perhaps to challenge the trial court's order and say the trial court abused its discretion in disallowing the deposition?
We absolutely believe that we are entitled to be present and to see the argument presented against us. I cannot imagine this court committing one side argument.
Why isn't your remedy vacation of the district judge's order? Why isn't it limited to that? If there was no evidence presented, it was just argument of counsel.
We believe under Rule 76 and 76A, and by virtue of due process principles, we're entitled to all of the information relating to a proceeding that decided the merits of our claim. And that, we believe respectfully, is what happened here. There was a hearing. Something was adduced to the judge, and we've been denied access to it. And I will add this final response, if I may. Bear in mind, if you will, that these concerns are often a balancing process. There isn't a black and there isn't a white. Due process is a flexible concept. But in this case, for the government to come to this court today, when the grand jury is discharged, when the witness never appeared before the grand jury, when the charges have already been filed and they don't include any tax charges against my client, when all that is history and it's been over a year, there is no just cause why my client should not now have access to this secret proceeding to which he's been denied access for these 2 years.
Does it make any difference that the prosecutor may have revealed information about ongoing proceedings that other than those just immediately affecting your client?
Not at all, because that grand jury has concluded its work. If she disclosed to the trial judge information relating to some other investigation, that grand jury has concluded its work over a year ago.
Would the government be precluded at presenting the same information or type of information to other grand juries?
A new grand jury could be convened, and the evidence of the prior grand jury proceeding could be offered to a new grand jury. But that grand jury is concluded, its investigations were concluded, it issued such indictments as it could or wished, and that proceeding is concluded, which is why we maintain again and again, it is unfair to seal against a party, not a third newspaper report, but to conceal from a party information unless there is powerful cause to do so. And there is existing today no cause to withhold from my client this information which was used to his prejudice in the course of that proceeding.
Mr. Davis, I hear your argument and substance being when the jury grand jury concludes its work, the oath of secrecy is off. Anything can be disclosed.
Absolutely. Well, I don't want to be quite that extreme. There's no open door once a grand jury has concluded its work for us to walk in and say we want a copy of the transcript. But the argument used in support of this secrecy principle and we don't want to publish the information, the argument advanced by the government in these cases is as long as there is a pending grand jury investigation, we don't want interference with that investigation. And I would say that investigation has concluded. And what is more, my client was not charged in connection with any tax issues at all.
What is the indictment about?
The indictment is about two matters. One is a bankruptcy matter, which occurred in the Northern District of Texas. And the second is tax issues relating to Mr. Jim Guy Tucker. Not my client's matters at all, in terms of his personal tax return. I will add also, the years involved here, tax years, from 1982 through 1987, all barred by the 6-year statute of limitations, my client could not be indicted in connection with those violations, even if they chose, wished to, or at least if they did, we'd get an immediate dismissal.
The merits of those defenses will be litigated by some of the court.
Yes, and the 1990 year, there was a question about the accuracy of the 1990 return. In any event,
questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your patient listening to me.
Very briefly, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. One factual aspect. After the Office of Independent Counsel received the sealed transcript of the record of these proceedings to be pellucidly clear, per the agreement of the parties, that sealed transcript was returned to the District Court. There should be no doubt whatsoever as to what the disposition was. There is equivocation in Mr. Davis's representation. There should be none. The process of our returning that record is absolutely clear. Point two, if 76A is not involved, then Mr. Davis is not properly here. The Chief Justice has flagged the issue. We came up to the Court of Appeals not because we wanted to be deflected further from our ongoing activity in Little Rock, but because an appeal was mounted. The justification or the asserted basis of the appeal was 76A, not Rule 76. If, in fact, he has a Rule 76 issue, it awaits final judgment, as the Chief Justice said. This Court would want appellate jurisdiction. Mr. Davis has not suggested to the contrary. I think there's been a number of questions that suggest concerns, and certainly Mr. Davis is concerned, that we were, in a due process violative sense, permitted to argue our case, not simply to provide information. And I want it to be clear. I think the record of the transcript on October 18th, the hearing on October 18th, makes, again, crystal clear that there was every opportunity given by the district judge to the other side. What did the other side think? What was the interest that was hanging in the due process balance? Was there an adjudication of Mr. Marks's rights? Is this the kind of case that was before the Texas courts in Bank One and cases of that kind, an actual adjudication of rights? What we have at issue underlying is the timing of a deposition, a pre-litigation deposition. And that is what makes the case from the Fifth Circuit so powerfully on point. One can point to factual distinctions, but one will not be able to point to a principal distinction between the two. And weighing in the balance, the Fifth Circuit found the interest there under the federal counterpart to Rule 187, the interest in taking a pre-litigation deposition, to be not very weighty when it came in the contrast to considering the interests of the United States and the orderly operation of the criminal justice system, including but not limited to grand jury secrecy.
That raises the question, what was the interest of the United States? Is Mr. Davis correct in saying that witnesses before grand juries have the right to disclose information? And does that follow that a target of investigation can depose in a civil proceeding any witness before grand jury and learn their testimony?
They can seek to do that, but that does trigger. I agree to the extent that they can invoke the rules of civil procedure and say, we're now going to, and I'm not suggesting that this is done, we don't need to get into intent, but we're now going to harass every grand jury witness who refuses to play ball with us under a joint defense agreement. We're going to sue them. And the first thing we're going to do, so we don't have to do two-way discovery, is we're going to file a pre-litigation, Rule 187 in Texas. And let's take their deposition, and we don't have to engage in reciprocal discovery. And I think ultimately that is what is the danger here. Yes, it can be done under Texas procedure, but what was at issue here was one of the timing of that process.
What's the government's interest in stopping that process?
The government's interest is the orderly processing of the grand jury, including availing itself of the information being provided by Mr. Fellman. Mr. Fellman was working with agents and providing very useful information, and those agents in turn. And I have to be careful what I say because I'm operating under the strictures of Rule 6E. But for, in fact, during the ongoing course of a grand jury investigation, for a witness or someone providing information to the grand jury or to officers of the United States to be subjected to a civil discovery process against his or her will does, in fact, implicate our interest and entitles us simply to come forward and to say, and they've not suggested here that we had, if I may conclude, they have not suggested that we have no standing to intervene, to make our interest known, and simply to say to the judge, as we did, Your Honor, we would urge a reasonable postponement. We're not saying adjudicate his rights. We're simply saying take some time and allow the grand jury at this especially sensitive stage of its proceedings to have its work done in an uninterrupted way.
Any other questions?
I thank you.